The German armed forces had some hints of what was happening, but never got a complete picture, for the various divisions of the German government didn't talk to one another much. When a Luftwaffe officer named Colonel Wolfgang Martini did finally decide to probe Britain's defenses in the last peacetime months of 1939 by trying to listen to any radio signals a radar network would be producing, he most usefully for Britain resolved to be extremely thorough. This meant he had to carry a lot of heavy equipment, and so he used a giant Zeppelin airship for the job. It was the Graf Zeppelin LZ-130, sister ship of the LZ-120 Hindenburg, which had exploded in America just 2 years before. He couldn't have chosen a better way of beaming his location to the British. Zeppelins were coated with shiny aluminum varnish, and aluminum is a metal, which meant that the surface of the Zeppelin consisted of hundreds of square feet of loosely attached electrons. It formed a perfect target, suspended conveniently high in the air. The first signals from Britain's radar stations whapped into the Zeppelin even before it had completed crossing the English Channel. Electrons in the Zeppelin's aluminum-painted skin immediately began shimmying from side to side, and so began pumping out miniature radio signals just as Wilkins had predicted. While the Zeppelin lumberingly hid in clouds during its reconnaissance mission up and down the coast, most of the high masts of the chain home station stayed quiet, giving away no trace of their operation. When the final Luftwaffe intelligence report on British preparedness was delivered in July 1940, it said nothing about the chain home system. By the summer of 1940, Germany's army had conquered most of Western Europe and was perched on the edge of the English Channel, just an achingly few miles short of Britain itself. The German Navy was assembling a huge invasion fleet, and if that got across the Channel successfully, the few armored British units that survived would be heavily outnumbered. Many British tanks had been destroyed or left behind in France. Churchill would likely be executed if he didn't escape to Canada. German administrators had lengthy lists of prominent Jews, trade unionists, clergy, and other undesirables who would be killed too. The Royal Navy would do what it could to block the invasion, but without command of the air, there was little chance it could succeed indefinitely. The RAF was the crucial barrier to Germany's advance, but it seemed feeble indeed. Spending had been low for fighter command, so although there were a good number of top-notch planes available, there weren't enough trained pilots to keep defensive patrols circling in the air. Hitler had only to get rid of this limited RAF, and then he could invade. The air attacks weren't expected to take more than a month, top German officers calculated. They would begin on August 13, 1940, Adlertag, or Eagle Day. Around 5:30 a.m., the radar operators in the easternmost radar stations in Britain detected a German air formation assembling over Amiens in France. Soon there was another one over Dieppe, then a third north of Cherbourg. The German pilots had every reason to think they were unobserved, for they had no way of detecting the electric and magnetic waves that surged through the metal wings of their planes and produced the signals that, only a fraction of a second later, were accurately received back in England. But when those several hundred planes did reach English airspace for their surprise attack, 10 RAF squadrons were waiting for them. As a contemporary observer put it, inhospitably, the reception committee turned all these overseas visitors away. It was Watson Watt's finest hour. Time after time, in the weeks after that, Germany tried to launch a surprise attack so it could take advantage of its superiority in numbers of planes. Later in August, for example, the German Air Force feinted with a huge attack on the south of England, while sending an even greater, secretly assembled air armada over from Denmark to attack what it was sure now had to be the undefended northeast. But when those attackers were still far over the North Sea, the RAF, with deadly pilots from Poland, Norway, and throughout the Commonwealth, swooped upon them. It helped that when a few suspicious German intelligence officers did promote attacks on what they thought might be radar stations, the British operators, mostly women, stayed calmly at their oscilloscopes despite substantial casualties. There was no change in the RAF's responses. The German high command was confused enough to conclude that perhaps the curious high masts weren't a central part of the British defense after all. Through the rest of August, and well into September, the radar stations continued directing one fresh group of RAF pilots after another straight to the fleets of attacking German planes. The RAF suffered large losses, but the Luftwaffe's were larger still. By the end of September, autumn storms in the Channel had begun, and on October 11th, Operation Sea Lion, the planned German sea invasion of Britain, was indefinitely postponed. Yet the British lead in radar didn't last. As German night attacks on London and other large cities continued, British radar operators noticed something disturbing about the Luftwaffe's tactics. The German planes were taking up accurate positions more quickly than they had before, even in total darkness. There was at least one occasion when German dive bombers based in France flew directly to a British destroyer 60 miles from shore and sank it, even though it had been well out of visual range. This was bad news. The Germans were not just catching up with the British in their use of radar, but surpassing them. Radar, so far, had been the hero, a protector of the nation. Yet once Britain learned how Germany was catching up, it would become a villain.